Right, okay, 5 past, so why don't we get on with it. We're focusing on knowing receipt. That's where we left off last night. If you recall, what we're doing is looking at the personal liability to account of people involved in financial institutions. By people, we might mean traders in relation to dishonest assistance. Yeah, the human beings who might assist in a breach of fiduciary duty, assist in a breach of trust dishonestly, but don't actually receive any property themselves. Yeah? Whereas, if you're a person who actually receives property, typically that will be the financial institution itself. Yeah? Money is paid into its accounts. It's more likely that it's going to be the institution itself that will receive the property. In some circumstances, of course, it may be human beings. But in what we're talking about in finance, it's more likely a trader will be assisting and it will actually be receipt by the financial institution. And so often that will be your preferred defendant if you're acting for the claimant because they'll have the most money. Yeah? So, we've got to show receipt and we discussed what receipt might mean last night. I'm like an idiot because it's a new handout and I haven't learned it yet. The cases on receipt are heading 3.4 on page 95. We made the points yesterday. LSU and Dollar Land Holdings Lord Justice Hoffman talks about, secondly, there being beneficial receipt by the defendant of assets, which sounds like it means you require some beneficial interest in the property. That formulation, without further discussion, has been applied in Charter, PLC and City Index by Chancellor Morrett, and in Zunta Impex and Standard Bank by Lord Justice Moore Bick. So that seems to be the one everyone's quoting nowadays without necessarily unpacking what it means. It hasn't really been a case where it's been such a huge issue yet. Whereas in Age of Africa and Jackson, Mr. Justice Millett, as we said yesterday, says there is receipt of trust property when a company's funds are misapplied by any person whose fiduciary position gave him control of them or enabled him to misapply them. So it's enough for Mr. Justice Millett that you have control of that property or you are able to misapply it. Which I would suggest means it's in your possession in some way that you're able to misapply. Would be one approach to that. So there we are, two slightly different approaches to receipt. Okay. So that's our actus reus, if you like. We've got to have received the property. The cases typically revolve around the mens rea element of knowledge, which is morphing into an idea of unconscionability. So where we got to last night, I was talking about Re-Montagu settlement and the idea back on pages 94 that we focus on the first three kinds of knowledge from Baden and Société Générale. Actual knowledge, willfully shutting one's eyes to the obvious, so-called Nelsonian knowledge, or willfully and recklessly failing to make the inquiries which an honest and reasonable person would have made. So what we have to ask in any particular circumstance, did the defendant actually know? If you could prove that, then probably you wouldn't need to be going to court. If there were emails, if there were letters, if there was some other evidence that that person actually knew, then it'd be fairly straightforward activity to make them personally liable to account. The more tricky ones on the cases have been where someone's been willfully shutting their eyes to the obvious. Okay, so is there something obvious? This money must have come from a tainted source. Yeah, it must have come from some kind of fiduciary relationship. So have you willfully, deliberately, intentionally shut your eyes to the obvious, ignored something? So we might say that Henwood was willfully shutting his eyes to the obvious in Barlow-Clough's Neurotrust. Or thirdly, have you willfully and recklessly failed to make inquiries which an honest person would have made? And this is an area where I think we get very close to financial regulation. Have you willfully and recklessly failed to make the inquiries which an honest person would have made? So you have to ask, what would an honest person have done? What would an honest person have asked? Where have you got this telly from? Why does it look like you've torn the lead out of a wall? Why are you running and sweating? Why do you only want 20 quid for it? You know, all that kind of stuff. Why are the police chasing you? What would an honest person have asked in that context? Query in the financial context. Given there are things we are supposed to do in the financial context if we are regulated persons,
in relation to conduct of business, and also in relation to money laundering, which we'll come back to later. Should we take the financial regulation as supplying a statement of what an honest person would do in those circumstances? Discuss with now we have to ask the question, was it willful and was it reckless to fail to make those inquiries in the context? Okay, so that's what you need to be asking, looking at any particular set of facts. So it's going to come down to headings 2 and 3 particularly. And why it was important for Vice-Chancellor McGarry and Reid Montague to knock out 4 and 5 is that all you needed to be liable under 4 and 5 was simply having knowledge of circumstances. You didn't have to be willful, you didn't have to be reckless, you simply had to know of something which would have put an honest and reasonable person on inquiry, or which would have indicated the facts to an honest and reasonable person. So much, much more likely you're going to be held liable under 4 and 5. So-called constructive notice ideas from borrowers and landlord, if you like, which their lordships have been very reluctant to apply to commercial cases. That's going to be one of our themes. Why are we so reluctant to do this in the case law when financial regulation seems to require something very different? Okay, so heading 3.2.1, as we talked about yesterday, what we get from Reid Montague's settlement is an idea that you can forget. And if you forget information, then you aren't deemed to have knowledge of it in terms of knowing receipt. I think what we have to ask in the law of finance is, given that related to the 10th Duke of Manchester, not a professional person, not acting in a professional capacity, who had forgotten the details of a settlement over property from many, many years before, can we translate that same idea to commercial people in the financial context who are managing funds, who are giving advice to the use of funds, who are employing traders to give that kind of advice? You know, excuse me. Would the financial context be distinguishable from Reid Montague, is basically what we're saying. Other cases. We have cases like Polypec and Nadir, which you may remember from last year. Polypec was another one of those corporate scandals that went on in that bit in the late 80s, and all the scandals actually going on in the late 80s, and we had to find out about it at the very end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, in which Azal Nadir was the controlling mind and will of the Polypec group of companies. And all sorts of well-known brands. And it transpires that somebody, in breach of fiduciary duty, was spiriting assets out of those companies. And this particular case, lots and lots of Polypec litigation. A wrinkle of company law, of course, that it's the company itself, as a legal person, that will be doing the suing. So it's always the company that's the claimant in these cases. Although what often has happened is when your controlling mind and will has scarpered, or all the old directors have gone, all the old shareholders have sold up, it's the new owners of the company, or it's the liquidator who's now in control of the company, that then turns around and starts acting as the claimant, you know, using the company, though, nominally as the claimant. Monies were spirited out of the Polypec group of companies and passed through a bank controlled by Azal Nadir. Flash, having a bank of your own. And those monies were transferred then to the Central Bank of Northern Cyprus. Something of a contentious point whether or not in international law there is a Central Bank of Northern Cyprus, but that's what it calls itself. I'm taking no position. The sterling was exchanged for Turkish lira through the central bank in the aggregate amount of about £45 million. So the central bank received the sterling. Yes. Okay, it paid out equivalent amount of Turkish lira, but it definitely received the sterling. It went into its accounts, it definitely got that sterling and paid out Turkish lira. Lira out the other side. So query whether or not there's a change of position or anything else, not an issue in this case. The question here, the issue in this case, was whether or not we could sue the central bank for being a knowing recipient of that money. Comes on in front of the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Scott, as then he was, said that we have to look at this from the perspective of an honest and reasonable banker. So looking at the circumstances of the case means we look at the specific circumstances, right, as a banking transaction. And also we look at it from the perspective of being a central bank, where a central bank will frequently deal in large sums of money. So yes, this is an enormous amount of money in this particular instance, but it was held by the Court of Appeal. It wasn't so extraordinary or so exceptional for a central bank that it would necessarily have put that central bank on inquiry. One of the things that Lord Justice Scott suggests is the question really is whether or not there's anything about the circumstances which ought to have made the bank suspicious. And I always think that's almost the acid test, really. I always think that's actually what trial judges are really looking at, hearing all the evidence. Because you're going to get evidence, of course, from the defendant saying, oh, there's nothing wrong, oh, you know, we do this all the time. And the plaintiff's barrister's going to be suggesting, yeah, it's a huge amount of money, you know. Surely you thought, it didn't even cross your mind? What kind of moron are you, you know? And so what the trial judge is really trying to get at is there something about the situation where you should really have realised there was something funny going on? Ought you to have been suspicious? Yeah, I think that's quite a nice conceptualisation of what trial judges are really thinking about. On these facts, there was nothing about the transaction about which, on its face, the central bank ought to have been suspicious. It's an idea, very well known in this region. And it was a central bank, large amounts of money passed through it from time to time. Therefore, no liability. So again, we might ask the question here. This is a banking transaction. So is this the standard to which we hold all financial institutions? Or is there something about it being a central bank that means it would tend to have much larger amounts of money passing through it? Do we distinguish between a small financial institution like a hedge fund, which, you know, may be speculating on a large amount but may not necessarily have huge amounts of money going through it, compared, for example, to a bank the size of Citigroup, where tremendous amounts of money are washing through it by minute, because Citigroup's business is to manage cash management and similar products across the globe, and a lot of organisations use Citigroup precisely because it has the wherewithal to move huge amounts of money around any jurisdiction in the world. So those kind of big banks, do we say they get one treatment? Are their circumstances different from the small? Lord Justice Scott is asking us to look at circumstances, you know, how far do we go with that? So I think, again, that's something we might want to be inquiring about, you know, looking at the facts of any particular problem. What's the scale here? Should that make a difference? Again, notice, though, there's no sense in this case that there's any positive obligation on the bank to make inquiries. It's far more of a passive suggestion. Was there anything about the situation that should have put them on inquiry? As opposed to, should they have gone and looked? If you think about how banking works, all numbers on computer screens, I mean, nothing is actually necessarily going to yell out as being suspicious. You know, it's just forms, bits of paper, it's, you know, bits of numbers on computer screens. You know, it's only going to be the size of a number that's going to put you on notice. But if you're a central bank and you have big numbers all the time, then, you know, what would be a suspicious transaction? Yeah? Somebody coming in and filling the form out actually in blood at your counter. It's difficult to know what is this thing that if you're just allowed to sit supine and not investigate things, you know, what would put you on notice? An absolutely astronomical number. I mean, you know, financial institutions have moved tremendous amounts of money around. I remember once being involved in a transaction which is for £1 billion a fund wanted to invest. And we thought, my heavens, £1 billion, we better work out where this is coming from. You know, but that's not an unusual amount of money to be shifting around in one-off transaction. You know, so there are huge numbers. So £45 million doesn't register on that basis. But, of course, banking regulation, as we've discussed when we did money laundering regulation, come back to this a bit later on, and when we've done conduct of business, banking regulation, financial regulation does impose positive obligations on financial institutions in many contexts. And so maybe the attitude of Lord Justice Scott is what the case law requires, but maybe banking regulation is doing something different. And on that same theme, McMillan and Bishopsgate. This is one of the other great collapses and scandals of the time, because of Robert Maxwell farrago. When Robert Maxwell died, we learned about all kinds of horrible things that were going on in various organisations that he controlled. One of the fabulous things that we get from Mr. Justice Millett, when large amounts of money are moving around companies and pension funds and so on controlled by Robert Maxwell, is the idea that account officers are not detectives. And let me give you this bit from the case. For those of you who are confused, this is a law report. This is a book and these are words. McMillan attempted to establish too much sarcasm. McMillan attempted to establish constructive notice on the part of each of the defendants by a meticulous and detailed examination of every document, letter, record or minute to see whether it threw any light on the true ownership of the bullet shares, which a careful reader, with instant recall of the whole of the contents of his files, ought to have detected. That is not the proper approach. Account officers in banks are not detectives. Unless and until they are alerted to the possibility of wrongdoing, they proceed and are entitled to proceed on the assumption that they are dealing with honest men. In order to establish constructive notice, it is necessary to prove that the facts known to the defendant made it imperative for him to seek an explanation, because in the absence of an explanation, it was obvious that the transaction was probably improper. So, Mr. Justice Millett, in talking about financial institutions, in talking about dealings with shares and movements of assets between various companies in this group, a lot of things we don't need to know about for present purposes. Account officers are not detectives. You are not required to go and find things out, according to Mr. Justice Millett, according to the case law. And this, I would suggest, is of a piece with Lord Justice Scott. Unless and until they are alerted to the possibility of wrongdoing. So unless you are alerted in some way, something comes to your attention. You've got to be alerted. It's not a mere inkling or a minor suspicion. You've got to be alerted. They proceed and are entitled to proceed on the assumption they're dealing with honest men. What a wonderful world. Here we are in my lane. You're entitled to assume you're dealing with honest men. Women, who knows? Perhaps we're supposed to read that as honest people. In order to establish constructive notice, which is what was being argued for in this case, it's necessary to prove that the facts known to the defendant made it imperative for him to seek an explanation. And again, that's pitched quite highly. Not just something fishy, or there's an inkling, or something smells a bit odd. It's got to be imperative for you to go and seek an explanation. So the case law is pitching all this quite high. It's only then that a trader or a financial institution would be on notice that there was something wrong with the transaction. Only then might we impute knowledge to them. If we go back in our handouts, so we're on page 94, so I'm going to get confused. We go back to page 45, back into money laundering. We spend our time, if you recall, primarily on the principal criminal offences in relation to money laundering. And we talked about whether or not there is knowledge of an offence. Yeah? So this is the criminal context. Cases like the Crown de Silva, we get this from Lord Justice Longmore. It seems to us, being the Court of Appeal, that the essential element in the word suspect and its affiliates in this context is that the defendant must think there is a possibility, which is more than fanciful, that the relevant facts exist. Remember, Lord Justice Scott is asking for us to look for suspicion. In this criminal context, it's got to be something that's more than fanciful, but it isn't being pitched as high as being something that's imperative for you to go and find out about. The statute does not require the suspicion to be clear or firmly grounded and targeted on specific facts or based upon reasonable grounds. To require the prosecution to satisfy such criteria is to strengthen as to the strength of the suspicion would not be putting a gloss on the section. So quite clearly in that context, for money laundering, the obligations on financial institutions are higher. A Crown's sake does read in the idea that it must also be a reasonable suspicion. Lord Hope, the assumption is that the person has a suspicion, otherwise he would not be thinking of doing what the statute contemplates. The objective test is introduced in the interests of fairness, to ensure that the suspicion has a reasonable basis for it. The subjective test, actual suspicion, is not enough. The objective test that there's reasonable grounds for it must be satisfied too. But we have a more objective approach, unusually, in criminal law here. Okay? So what I'm suggesting to you is that the case law in relation to money laundering is putting a different kind of obligation on banks. As long as your suspicion is more than merely fanciful, as long as it's reasonable, then you have to act on it, or otherwise you commit an offence. Whereas in private law, talking about knowing receipt, it seems to be much more relaxed. It's when we get to something we didn't spend a huge amount of time on when we did money laundering, because I like you too much. When we look at the Money Laundering Regulations 2007, which is in the textbook, this is actually the page numbers from the practitioner edition, but it's the same paragraph numbers. When we're talking about financial institutions and anyone governed by the money laundering regulations, which we talked about briefly when we did money laundering law, the regulated persons are required to conduct due diligence in relation to their customers. This must be done by using documents, dates and other information which have been acquired from a reliable source. In particular, this means identifying their customer and verifying their identity to prevent their identity being misused. And then there's a whole list of things in the money laundering regulations that financial institutions are required to do. They're required to investigate record-keeping procedures. They're supposed to have internal procedures and training. They have to be registered with their appropriate regulator. And they commit criminal offences if they don't investigate properly the clients they're dealing with. So the money laundering regulations do impose positive obligations as to customer due diligence, know your client, finding out about your client, what's the source of these payments. So banks taking deposits, if you remember, it includes casinos and bureaux de change and all kinds of entities that might be dealing with money in relation to customers and clients, to conduct investigations into those customers and clients. So there are positive obligations in one context, and yet private law is saying account officers are not detectives. It's only if there's something about the transaction to make you suspicious that you'll be deemed to have any knowledge of it. So we seem to have the case law going in one direction, and financial regulation going in the other. Okay. So, commentary point there would be, apply the case law to the facts in front of you, and then say, however, is this supportable in this context, given the tension between the case law not imposing positive obligations, and yet money laundering law generally imposing positive obligations, conduct of business regulation imposing positive obligations. If there are things you should have found out about if you'd been compliant with your regulatory obligations, should you be taken to have knowledge of that? Is that what an honest and reasonable banker would have done, should have done? Okay, so that becomes the commentary question. And so that might lead us to a very different answer in many of these cases. You might get off on the old case law, but if we start to adapt it in relation to the regulations, maybe things would be different. Okay? So having belaboured that, if we slip back to page 94, LSU and Dollar Land Holdings, very useful case, because the other issue we're going to have to deal with, and I'll think I'll do it now, is how do we attribute knowledge to corporate entities? Okay. LSU and Dollar Land Holdings is very useful for this. So there are more cases on liability to account in corporate context under heading 4 on page 95. But LSU is the leading case, the most useful case on this in this context anyway. LSU and Dollar Land Holdings, we have investment funds in Geneva. And some fraudsters organise that funds are going to be taken out of that fund and basically laundered around the world. They move through a number of different jurisdictions, until eventually the fraudsters arrive in London and identify Dollar Land Holdings as being a company in which they want to invest. think this is a good place to park the money that we've looted from this investment fund. So there's been a breach of fiduciary duty there in Geneva. Money's been laundered around the world, ends up at Dollar Land Holdings. It's the chairman of Dollar Land Holdings who is involved in this transaction. Let me explain what a chairman is in company law, modern company law terms. Modern company law terms, the chairman is a non-executive director, so usually won't be involved in the day-to-day running of the business. That's usually run by the chief executive, using the modern parlance, and the executive directors. Non-executives are there to make sure the executives behave, don't pay themselves too much, that the audit is done properly, and those sorts of things. Okay? So if you're doing company law, you may have got to that yet, you may not, but that's the distinction. So it's the non-executive chairman, not involved in the day-to-day management of the business, who meets these fraudsters, organises the investment coming into Dollar Land Holdings, and a particular property development they're involved in. The question is, when the beneficiaries, effectively, of the fund in Geneva realised fraud, when they've done all the detective work of working out where the money has moved around the world and realised how it ended up in Dollar Land Holdings, the question then is, did the chairman have knowledge, and can that knowledge be attributed to Dollar Land Holdings, the company itself? Because when we're talking about enormous amounts of money, there's often little point in suing the human beings because they usually won't have enough money to account for all the loss. So here we want to sue the company because they're the ones with the money. And Mr. Justice Millett, at first instance, took the view that the chairman wasn't the controlling mind and will of the company. He was a non-executive. He didn't have control of the day-to-day management of the business, and therefore anything the chairman knew couldn't be attributed to the company. The Court of Appeal, however, disagreed and overturned Mr. Justice Millett. Their approach was, we have to look at this situation transaction by transaction. Particularly Lord Justice Hall. On these facts, in relation to this particular transaction, it was the chairman who was the controlling mind of the company. You don't have to be the controlling mind for 100% of everything. It's enough if the transaction is sufficiently significant that you're the controlling mind or the directing will of the company for that particular activity. And therefore, on these facts, it was held that the chairman should have had knowledge. You could impute the knowledge to him on these facts of what had happened in the background. And because he was the controlling mind in relation to this large transaction, this large investment into the company, then his knowledge could be imputed to the company, and the company, therefore, would be a knowing recipient of that money. So what becomes difficult in relation to banking transactions? I think this question remains at large, and therefore is a fun one for you to write about,
yes,
and argue your way through. Is if we have a large financial institution, a large investment bank, say, employing a large number of traders, what happens when we have one particular trader who is involved in a deal? Which means that the financial institution receives money in breach of a fiduciary duty. So we have a pension fund out there, for example. The trader talks to these people from the pension fund. The trustees of the pension fund, in breach of trust, want to funnel money through this investment bank. And that trader had actual knowledge, or ought to have made inquiries which an honest and reasonable person would have made and didn't, or didn't conduct of business, or didn't conduct money laundering due diligence. Okay. Question then is, can we attribute that individual trader's knowledge to the investment bank? And that's going to depend, like LSU and Dollar Land Holdings, on whether that person can be said to be the controlling mind of the company, the investment bank, in relation to this particular transaction. So we need to know things like how many traders were there, how senior was this person. We need to know about the size of this transaction. Is it something sufficiently significant? Because the case law's approach is going to be, there's only something about the arrangement that ought to have made you suspicious, and it's only if it's sufficiently large, as in Polly Peck and the Deer. However, we've already mentioned some of the banking regulation. We know about conduct of business, the things you're supposed to inquire into about your clients, you have to classify those for deeds and all kinds of other things. Money laundering regulation, we've got to do due diligence on our customers as well. So in these circumstances, should we put a positive obligation on an investment bank to make sure it has systems in place whereby all of these clients and sources of their funds are investigated? So the case law is going to be slightly slower to impose liability. But I think if you add in the financial regulation to that mix as well, we might say, well, in policy terms, you know, when we're dealing with financial institutions that are regulated by the FSA and are covered by money laundering regulation in the UK and everything else, then they ought to be on inquiry anyway, and therefore, going back to the Baden categories of knowledge, these are the sorts of inquiries which an honest person would have made, which an honest banker would have made. And if they fail to do it, well, query, are they doing that willfully? So that's the kind of debate you want to get into. Yeah. It seems to me personally that we should always impose positive obligations on banks to investigate these things. That must be what the FSA handbook requires. And therefore I think the case law ought to adapt to reflect that. Personally, you're allowed to disagree, obviously. You know, in the wake of the recent financial crisis, is an inability in the legal system and the regulatory system generally to inquire into what investment banks were doing in the detail of their transactions exactly the problem? You know, it ought the case law to realise that we need to be on the front foot. But notice this is exactly not what Mr Justice Millett in Millett and Bishopsgate, exactly not what Lord Justice Scott and Polly Peck and the Deer were requiring. Okay. So it would require a big change in the case law. So that's, you know, there's a whole range of stuff to get into there. What would the cases actually require? And there's a whole bunch of commentary you can put on just by talking about the regulation too. Okay. I mean, this isn't an area in which there's a huge amount of articles written. It's not like people discussing Caparo and Dickman or all that other kind of stuff, trusts of homes or something like that. But I mean, these are exactly the debates that are out there. So just kicking around this stuff, that's all you need to do to get those 70s you deserve for being the 50% of the people that actually come. Anyway, right. Everyone else in bed, presumably. Unconscionability. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what's happened in BCCI and Akin Daly. Because this is the debate about whether or not the change, a change is being wrought in the test. Lord Justice North says this. It's difficult to know whether or not we have actually moved to something else. A lot of the commentators, I mean James Kenner and John Lowry, for example, writing about company law in Dignam and Lowry, are taking the view this is just a general test of unconscionability, and oh my God, what does that mean? I don't think Lord Justice North is actually that loose. What then, in the context of knowing receipt, notice he still uses that expression, is the purpose to be served by a categorisation of knowledge? It can only be to enable the court to determine whether, in the words of Lord Justice Buckley in Belmont Finance, the recipient can conscientiously retain the funds against the company, or in the words of Sir Robert McGarry, Vice-Chancellor of Montague Settlements, the recipient's conscience is sufficiently affected for it to be right to bind him by the obligations of a constructive trustee. But if that is the purpose, there is no need for categorisation. All that is necessary is that the recipient's state of knowledge should be such as to make it unconscionable for him to retain the benefit of the receipt. Now, so that's where the debate is about unconscionability, as you remember from looking at Akin Daly last year. And that last sentence, all that is necessary is that the recipient's state of knowledge should be such as to make it unconscionable for him to retain the benefit of the receipt. So we might say that all that Lord Justice North is doing, rather than striking out in an entirely new direction, is saying this is still about testing that person's knowledge and then asking whether or not they've acted unconscionably in the context. For these reasons, his Lordship continued, I have come to the view that, just as there is now a single test of dishonesty for knowing assistance, so ought there to be a single test of knowledge for knowing receipt. We thought there was before you said this, Your Lordship. The recipient's state of knowledge must be such as to make it unconscionable for him to retain the benefit of the receipt. So in effect, we've got to show knowledge and conscience. A test in that form, though it cannot any more than any other avoid difficulties of application, ought to avoid those of definition and allocation to which the previous categorisations have led. Moreover, it should better enable the courts to give common sense decisions in the commercial context in which claims in knowing receipt are now frequently made. So this is a judicial attempt to introduce common sense to commercial situations. We ask whether or not that person has knowledge, and then whether or not it's unconscionable for them to act as they have. So we have to assume that the tests of knowledge are still going to be those based on the first three categories in Baden. And then we just graft an idea of unconscionability over the top, which I don't think is just a scary test then of, oh my goodness, is this unconscionable in the abstract, which is what a lot of commentators have tried to suggest it is. Over the page, top of page 95, Lord Justice Carnwath, and we spent some time on this, if you remember, in Property 2 last year, had a go at explaining what this means in Charter PLC and City Index, Court of Appeal. Liability for knowing receipt, held his lordship, depends on the defendant having sufficient knowledge of the circumstances of the payment to make it unconscionable for him to retain the benefit or pay it away for his own purposes. So it's about having knowledge and it also being unconscionable. So a lot of this stuff we bolted into the court last year because that case was decided, for example, after the last edition of the textbook. It's in the current edition of Equity and Trust, if you want to dig that out, Short Loan. It's also in all the stuff that I've put on Blackboard for you, which is taken from the practitioner edition of the Law of Finance, okay? So all that law is discussed there. Bless you. If you want to get into all that, okay? So there's that another debate there about what's the test for knowing receipt now. It seems to me that it's still primarily based on knowledge. What happened in BCCI and Akindele was this. Chief Akindele, a much prized client of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which went spectacularly bankrupt due to astonishing amounts of internal fraud. Again, another one of these the crises and collapses. What's interesting about the late 80s and early 90s is the amount of fraud, the amount of one-off collapses there are, whether it's corporate scandals, whether it's banks like BCCI failing. But we didn't have a big systemic problem. We had lots of problems of, you know, small bits of fraud. I mean, huge in numerical terms. You know, it's kind of one organisation at a time. And then we get Enron and WorldCom and all of those as well later in that decade. And then we've had a big systemic crisis. One of the things to bear in mind, I suppose, is that capitalism seems to have these little crises and problems and scandals all the time. And everyone thinks, oh, we only get a big crisis once in a while. Maybe we only get a huge one once in a while. But there's lots of little crises going on a lot. Huge amount of fraud. Good for lawyers. And so... Akindele was acquiring given products, investment products from BCCI. The returns he was paid were much larger than he was entitled to under his contracts, because the bank's employees had decided they wanted to keep him on as a client because he was very important, a prestige client, in effect, for bringing other clients in, to make a long story short. So it seems that they decided internally, let's pay this guy more, let's keep him sweet. Yeah. Now, if we'd have used all five of the Baden categories, we might have been able to say, well, he had knowledge of circumstances which might have put on his personal inquiry. Have I really done this well? I thought the markets were tanking. Really? Remember? There were lots of, the bond market crashed in the early 1990s, there were specific rim collapses, there's the Russian banking moratorium, and the markets went through a really sticky phase. Long-term capital management failed, and there's some really big failures. So he was getting a really high return. Now, the problem for Lord Justice Norse here was his feeling that he didn't want to hold this person liable. Yeah. Under that technical test about knowledge, yes, we might have said he might have had knowledge of circumstances, but, he said, I just don't think in these circumstances that this person has acted unconscionably. So in effect, what Lord Justice Norse is doing is giving himself a way out to let that particular defendant off, even though you might fall under the literal tests as set out in Baden. Possibly even if we just restrict it to the first three. If we're then also able to put a gloss over the top of that and say the defendant must also be shown to have acted unconscionably, then it enables us, in practice, to let people off. And that seems to be how it's been used in practice when it's been an issue. So there's that debate from kind of within equity about what precisely is the test. So I would suggest you could just apply the Baden categories of knowledge, the first three, after Montague, to the facts, see what your conclusion is, and then ask, if we ask generally whether or not this person's acted unconscionably, could that lead to a different conclusion? And then you can get into debate about where should the law go, given the context of financial regulation, I would suggest. Get 75% and a fantastic training contract and all that stuff. Just to move on to talk about some of the cases which have perhaps made a link between regulation and commercial standards and tests of knowledge and dishonesty. Okay. And on the handout, I'm on page 95, we've talked about liability in corporate contexts. LIGU is the most important case there. In company law, generally, it's a controlling mind test. Who's the controlling mind of the company? Tesco Stores and Naturists is a House of Lords case on that. Crown, Dillman and Sutton, more recently, rehearses much of the debate. Something you're bound to do in company law, those will be doing that. We know that employees and other fiduciaries can be liable personally, like Royal Brunei against Tan. And we looked at 4.3 at the idea yesterday that all investment involves risk. We're coming on to 4.4. And it's an idea we get from Cowander Group Properties and Eagle Trust. A very long case, which, to make a long story short, concerns a fraudulent scheme to sell a company's assets to another company at an undervalue, so that second company is then able to sell the assets, land, at its market value. There's a scheme. Sell assets for about £900,000, one of the bits of land goes for, and then it sells ultimately for £1.7 million. It's just a way of sell the land at an undervalue, and then the buyer can then sell it for its real value. So the questions, amongst other things, are whether or not one group of defendants have acted in a commercially reasonable manner in the way they've conducted the valuation of the land and the sale of the land. And the allegation is, amongst other things, that they have acted dishonestly. This is 1992, so it's before Royal Brunei against Tan, but the allegation is still about whether or not they've acted dishonestly. And we get this from Mr. Justice Knox in Cowander Group. This whole page, 761, I think is useful, and the All England Report, but... look at these enormous, don't write in enormous paragraphs like this. This paragraph was on for about two pages. I still conclude, Mr. Samuelson should not be treated as having the requisite knowledge. I state my conclusion in terms of the classification of services in Baden, because that's the way in which it's been argued between the parties. I share the reservations expressed by Mr. Justice Merton, Ashup and Jackson regarding over-refinement in making the distinctions implicit in that classification, or a too ready assumption that categories 4 and 5 and necessarily case of constructive notice. Let me zoom in a bit. I'm now talking to the machine. In my judgment, it may well be that the underlying broad principle which runs through the authorities regarding commercial transactions is that the court would impute knowledge on the basis of what a reasonable person would have learnt to a person who was guilty of commercially unacceptable conduct in the particular context involved. The banker in Westpac and Savin, which is a New Zealand case, who took a 3-to-1 chance regarding the source of the sums paid into the debtor's account but the banker in Thompson and Clydesdale was not guilty of such conduct. What's all that about? I think there's an interesting little seed, which quite a few barristers have seized on subsequently, that if you're guilty of commercially unacceptable conduct, that will prima facie suggest that you should be treated as having knowledge of the things you would otherwise have known. And you'll prima facie be treated as being dishonest. My judgment, it may well be that the underlying broad principle which runs through the authorities regarding commercial transactions, so special rule for commercial transactions, is that the court will impute knowledge on the basis of what a reasonable person would have learned to a person who is guilty of commercially unacceptable conduct in the particular context involved. So has there been commercially unacceptable conduct? But for that, what would a reasonable person have known? So I think from that scene we can start to think, therefore we're able to look at what's commercially acceptable conduct in that context. And in the financial context, query, discuss, perhaps it's looking at financial regulation that will tell us what is commercially reasonable conduct in that context. So that seems to go slightly against what Polly Peckham, the DA number two, was saying, Lord Justice Scott. It's whether or not you ought to have been suspicious. Which what we might say is, well, you know, if money laundering regulation requires you to do due diligence, if conduct of business regulation requires you to get involved in know your client, then isn't that a statement of what commercially acceptable conduct would have been? So we get this mentions of this idea, looking down the bullet-pointed list under 4.4. In cases like Heinle and Jyske Bank from 1999, Mr. Justice Coleman suggests in passing that contravention of financial regulation itself might suggest dishonesty. Now, these are all cases which are following on after Wellbred Islands against Tan. And Heinle and Jyske Bank is one of those cases that says, actually, the test for dishonesty should apply to knowing receipts as well. It's a short-lived run of cases. They really got into dishonesty, some of these courts of appeal decisions and High Court. Assembly Bank of Scotland and A Limited, same idea. You know, prima facie, should a contravention of banking regulation itself constitute dishonesty? If you fail to do what you should have done there, should that not mean you should be treated as having knowledge of things you would have found out otherwise? These are all overture remarks in passing, I would suggest, but there's a kind of a sense of something in there. Sphere Drake Insurance and Euro International involves a very short-lived insurance market. People will buy and sell anything, pretty much. That's how the world seems to work. There was a short-lived market in effectively uninsurable risks here. They're risks that clearly no one else is going to insure, but on which people had already written insurance policies in the past. The way the insurance market works is that somebody writes the insurance policy in the first place, and then they try and distribute the risk amongst other people in the market, so-called reinsurance. You try and get other people to buy up bits of the risk from you. So there's a market in buying and selling bits of insurance policies, basically. The return you make on that are the premiums you receive, your share of the customer's premiums. The risk you run is that the insurance contract requires you to pay out. Okay? So you're selling out little bits of the risk. A bit like syndicated loans. It's the same kind of idea. You want to spread the risk of that huge loan. In this particular market, we have the defendant selling bits of these insurance contracts, even though the insurance market generally has said, we're not writing any more of this business. It's like anything. Even Lehman Brothers shares, you know, just before they actually became bankrupt, you remember from last week's documentary, were worth 3 cents. They were still worth something. You might actually have been able to sell your shares for 3 cents. I mean, not much, given that you might have bought them for $40, but you would have got 3 cents for them. So there's a tiny bit of money to be made from selling these contracts. Okay? Sure enough, that market did crash. But the defendant here was selling to inexpert people, people daft enough, basically, to buy this stuff. Thinking, oh, that's cheap. It was held on the facts that in the regulatory context for insurance business, which at this time wasn't governed by the FSA, but in this particular context, this was commercially unacceptable conduct to be selling this kind of thing that you knew was incredibly risky to these kinds of customers. So this is outside FSA regulation. Very, very loosely regulated market at the time. But that, in itself, the fact that it was commercially unacceptable conduct, taking evidence from other people in the market, and so on and so forth, meant that the defendant was found to be dishonest. Selling this kind of stuff to these kind of people was not what honest people should have been doing in the market at the time. Manolo Kaki and Constantinides, we have a woman who comes to take advice from solicitors, says all she wants to do is buy property in the UK, basically so one of her kids can come to university. That seems to be the forefront of what's at her mind. And she's convinced by solicitors and by financial advisors the solicitors introduce her to that she should get involved in all kinds of investment strategies. You don't just want to be buying a flat for your daughter to stay while she's studying here. You can invest in all kinds of stuff. And she is encouraged, basically, into a whole web of complex financial transactions far beyond what she really wanted to do to start with. Now, this isn't governed by FSA regulation. is that it's governed by Law Society regulation. In this particular case, when we ask whether or not the solicitors had acted dishonestly or not. And the solicitors had done all kinds of terrible things. They backdated documents, they'd falsified documents, they'd really messed around and misled this woman horribly, made all kinds of misrepresentations to her. It was held that we could decide whether or not they were honest or dishonest, says Mr. Justice Smith, by looking at the regulations in place and enforced by the Law Society over solicitors, and also at guidance notes circulated by the Law Society as to the ways in which solicitors ought to treat their customers. So we can look at things that aren't even regulations formally. We can also look at guidance notes too. And here it was held that these solicitors hadn't done what an honest person should have done. What's important for our purposes, we can look at regulations, another example of this, and also look at guidance notes. So remember, the FSA handbook contains things with the letter R at the end of it, which suggests a rule, and also has things with the letter G, which suggests it's merely a guidance note. Even that will guide us as to what an honest person would have done in the market, and therefore if you fail to do that, you will be dishonest. So here we have some cases which seem to suggest that that bridge is possible between regulatory standards and what the substantive law does. And that seems to militate against what Polly Peckham here and Macmillan and Bishopsgate have been doing up to now. The idea, a lovely metaphor, that account officers are not detectives, seems to be an idea that we're going to make equity attractive to commercial people, ironically at the same time as commercial law, particularly financial regulation, is going in the exact opposite direction. Okay? So there's a great paradox there, I think, to play with in terms of essay writing, where's the link between substantive law and financial regulation, and also in terms of problem answering and commentary. Okay. Fertile ground. Jolly good. When next we come, we'll talk briefly about tracing. It's not an examinable topic, so we're just going to remind you of what it's about. It's important in banking law, but not examinable here. And then we're going to move on to the banker-customer relationship. Okay? Have good weekends and all those other things that you'll probably be determined to do.